Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Michael Graham. Michael is the published author of the book From Guru to God, An Experience of the Ultimate Truth. Michael ventured to India at age 22 and spent thousands of hours meditating and studying with various mystics. Later, Michael worked as a consultant in a corporate telecommunication firm in Australia and then developed his own personal development program, the Decision Principle Training, taught by him internationally. In 1995, Michael had a remarkable visionary encounter that led him to become the most surprised convert in Christendom. Michael continues to live, work and teach in Melbourne while writing and editing his new book, Modern Day Wisdom, a practical workbook. Hey Michael, welcome to the Love Osho podcast. How are you?
Thank you very much. Delighted to be with you today.
Great. It's my pleasure. So today is really a special episode with a special guest. It's going to be really fascinating talk, discussing some unknown details about Vivek's life and background. Vivek, later known as Nirvana, was Osho's most intimate disciple. And we dedicated a whole episode to Nirvana with Vina, that's episode 60. But today you bring a different perspective because you met Vivek before she even knew Osho. And in fact, as far as I understand, and I want to hear about that, you are the person who introduced Vivek to Osho. So I'd love to start from there. So how did you know Vivek?
Well, I was in Bombay in 1971, March, April, May, possibly. And I'd become very good friends in 1969 with a very refined young Indian, an intellectual, if you like, very reflective about the meaning and significance of life and given a lot of thought to that. I think he met Vivek probably in Germany, very interesting fellow, and he must have invited her to India. Well, she came to India, and I think if I remember correctly, and this is, do you realize this is 50 years ago? And I'm dredging my memory as best I can. She was probably staying with Ravi and his parents, and of course I turned up one day. And Ravi had known about Osho. He might have visited him once, but I was due to go and see him since he'd come on strong recommendations from Ravi. And I said to Vivek, of course, her name was Christine Wolfe. No Vivek at this point. She was an English girl. And a couple of years later, I'd stayed with her with her parents in Brighton, I think it was, in England for a few days. Anyway, she was there. And I suggested, let's go and see Acharya Rajneesh in those days. He was holding court, if you like, in his apartment at Woodlands, Kemp's Corner, in his bedroom, for very few people. And it was Thursday mornings, I think, that he addressed those who were interested. And she kind of, okay, nothing better to do, perhaps. She was a standard woman, a standard young woman. No mysticism, no yoga, no meditation, nothing like that. Straight as an arrow, conventional, conservative. And so she came along this day, and we were ushered into Osho. I might have seen Osho on my own once before, I think. But anyway, we were ushered into his bedroom. There were probably no more than six or seven of us at most. And he would be sitting in the corner of his bedroom in a chair with arms, not a grand chair of any sort, but his bed was on the right. He was there. I noticed a bullworker under his bed, which was fascinating, which was an isometric exerciser. And I was a little bit on the fit side, and I knew those. I thought, oh, that's interesting for a start. But he was sitting there, and we gathered, six or seven of us. He was a very fine-looking man, beautiful hands and beautiful feet, I remembered, as he was sitting there. And he would invite us to ask a question. And someone would merely ask a question, and then he'd close his eyes. it wasn't an instant response. It would probably be a full 3 or 4 seconds, which is a long time when you're waiting for a response. And he would boot up this extraordinary database of his, and he'd respond. And he'd talk to us for about 1 hour without drawing breath. So it was very interesting. And previously to this, I'd been with Swami Muktananda, and I'd received a very dramatic awakening with extraordinary attendant spiritual experiences. So I was cleaved to that. I was very attached to that. And the difference between Osho and Muktananda was that Muktananda was very conservative sannyasi, orthodox, whereas Bhagwan was liberal, progressive, with a huge data of understanding across the broadest spectrum of anthropology, psychology, spirituality, east, west, every corner. And I loved that. It was frightfully refreshed by his understanding. So I was there and intrigued, fascinated, and I enjoyed it. So Vivek and I went there 5 or 6 or 7 Thursdays, I'm sure. And in the meantime, she came to stay with me in a little hotel right there near the gateway of India, right near the water. Seashore Hotel, I think it was called. But then came the time for Osho to speak about a retreat in Mount Abu. I thought, well, that sounds interesting, and I was up for anything in those days. Previously, I'd been in Muktananda's ashram, and now I was repairing, if you like, relaxing a little in Bombay. And I thought, great idea. And then I suggested it to Vivek. Well, she was, maybe. Well, so come on, nothing better. Come on, let's go. Okay, we'll go up there. So we all piled on a train, of course. There must have been 35, 40 people. If I remember, predominantly Indians, but there would have been 5, 6, 7, 8 Westerners, I suppose. And up we went to Mount Abu. So anyway, I think the retreat was conducted over a week, perhaps, or maybe 5 or 6 days. I can't remember exactly. But each day in the earliest morning, perhaps at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning, we'd assemble on this hillside, well-grassed, and Bhagwan, or Acharya Rajneesh, as we knew him in those days, he sat in a large chair in front of about 30 or 40 of us, ready to do chaotic meditation with the Bhastrika Pranayama, the heavy breathing, and if I remember correctly, the intonation of who, H-U, who, I think so. And anyway, that was very interesting to me. I'd had a lot of such experiences without having to do any volitional practice to induce the manifestations that typically happen. I got that from Muktananda. But here I was particularly fascinated to come under Bhagwan's teaching because of his marvelous framework of understanding into which he placed spirituality and the path towards enlightenment. So, but the interesting thing was that Vivek, she couldn't join in. She thought, this is weird. She when she was exposed to Osho, Acharya, the whole thing was very new to her. So I suppose by the 4th or 5th session with him, she was starting to get some sort of a framework of understanding what this was all about, but the chaotic meditation must have been a bit much for her in that at that time. So instead of participating, she'd be up about 30 yards up one side to us, up on the hillock, just sitting. So sitting there like this, and didn't participate. I think she must have been there for one day at least. But then on the second day, perhaps it was, Bhagwan beckoned to her. Come down. So down she went, and Osho whispered or spoke into her ear just for a very short time. I think it must have been more than a minute or so, which is probably a long time when you were observing this. And not only that, I had a wonderful movie of this whole thing and the whole event. I was a slight off to one side. I made a movie and I gave it to my Yoga Lakshmi after this whole thing. It must be in your archive somewhere. Anyway, she gave me back a copy of the movie, and the copy that I received back was no good because it was made in India in 1971. Perhaps they couldn't make them. But anyway, so Bhagwan whispered into the ear of Vivek, And the next day she came to the session. I'm not sure whether or not she participated, but from that day, I hardly ever saw her again, because I think she was invited into the residence of Osho at that time at Mount Abu. So that was fascinating. But the fascinating thing was this, that she went from a standard, very straightforward, charming young woman into sort of very blown out, shucktified kind of woo, spaced out, very different girl, almost overnight. It's an extraordinary change.
Yes. Okay. So I think it's interesting to hear a little bit more about this transformation. And we always, all of us sannyasins, we know about Vivek and Nirvana as the most intimate disciple of Osho, but we don't know much about how she was before. And maybe it's not that interesting on a spiritual level, but I think for me, it's interesting to hear how a very conservative, standard, straight lady, as you described her. First of all, how she even ended up in India, and then how she overcame her resistances. Because initially, you just said that for a few weeks you were going to Bhagwan and she was not very impressed. And then the first dynamic meditation, she was like, this is weird, it's not for me. And then all of a sudden, boom, she becomes the closest disciple of Osho. That's quite extraordinary.
Well, that's a good summary you've given. And not only that, her change was not marginal. It was radical, extraordinary, huge change of regard for Osho and her mood, her temperament, everything. She was blown away, if you like, and spaced out in a good way, I'm sure. Now, on the way back to Bombay on the train after the retreat, I didn't see her. She must have stayed with Osho, but she was on the train on the way back and she was conversing with other people at that point, I'm sure. But I contracted hepatitis during that time. And Bhagwan was, I arrived in Bombay feeling rotten. And they all knew about it. Bhagwan was told about it. And he made an extraordinary, he said, Michael, come and stay with me, which was remarkable. And I stayed with him literally in his own apartment. There was Osho in his bedroom. It was me in another bedroom. And there was another bedroom. I think there might have Swami Chaitanya might have been in there, if I can't remember the name exactly. There was Lakshmi there. Lakshmi was his private secretary. Then there was a young, a former Orthodox Swami who joined Bhagwan. And I was there for 10 full days, which was quite remarkable, living on only coconut juice to try to recover from that condition, which I did recover in 10 days. But during that time, I saw a little bit more of Osho in his bedroom, but he came out of his bedroom but once in 10 days, never came out. And we got the impression, I got the impression, I don't think it was just an impression, but I understood that Bhagwan was never well. He looked well, but he wasn't physically robust. And I think it was not long after that that they might have removed the carpets from his bedroom, concerned that he was having an allergic reaction to woolen carpets or something like that. But he came out, and around the walls of the apartment must have been 1,000 books. The walls were covered in books. And I can remember picking a few books down off the shelf, and they were all marked. So many of them. Everyone I looked at had been marked. And it was Ma Yogalakshmi who told me that he was reading 11 books a day, which I thought was remarkable. I mean, he was a genius of sorts. He may well have been able to do that. And
how many books did you say?
Oh, 1,000 at least, 1,000 or 2,000 books on the shelf. Huge, as far as one huge wall of books, another wall to one side of books. And he was a prolific reader.
And how many per day he would read?
Lakshmi told me that he was reading 11 books a day. Extraordinary. And again, they were marked, which was sort of proof for me that someone had been leafing through them. It would have been no one else but him. And interesting, I remember I was there the day that 40 books on Scientology arrived in a huge big box. And this was 1971. And he got stuck into those, I believe. And he made an interesting comment. He said, oh, they'll probably be producing an enlightened person within 40 years. I thought, well, that was interesting. Of course, some of the less desirable aspects of Scientology and its cultish nature were not revealed until a little later, I think. But there was interesting stuff by L. Ron Hubbard. That was it. Anyway, so I stayed there for 10 days, and I saw little, very little to nothing of Vivek. And it was only about perhaps a year later, when she went back to England, that I met her again. I spent those days with her and her mother and father. But during that time, it was very interesting. Little things, the trivial things that you might have an interest in. For example, there was a Swami Chaitanya. Do I have that name right? Is that, do you have a recollection? Do you know about the history of this chap or not? No, perhaps not. Anyway, there was a mini kerfuffle because Bhagwan had some grey hair, and all of a sudden it was black. And Lakshmi had told Swami Chaitanya that he said, "How come he's lost his grey hair?" And Lakshmi told Chaitanya that Bhagwan had been doing pranayama and it had changed. So it turned out when he found out that he dyed his hair a little black, which is fair enough, Chaitanya was very upset that he'd been misled about that. I'm just trying to think of other thoughts about what happened during those 10 days. During that time, I think this was about 4 or 5 weeks before neo-sannyas had been instituted. And there would have been no more than 5 or 6 neo-sannyasis at the time. Oh, I'm thinking of other things now. That's very good. And there was a woman called Ma Yoga Dao, T-A-O, I think, a very well-covered, a very large woman, Indian. There was a Sadaji or Sikh who adopted the orange robe with Bhagwan's mala. There was a very young Swami called Swami Krishna Christ, an American, who was there. And, of course, there was Ma Yoga Lakshmi, and there may well have been Ma Yoga Mukta, who, of course, was the Greek, well-to-do Greek woman, who later, I think, maybe even today, she's in Pune, I don't know. But all this was...
She passed away, Mukta.
She did? Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Okay. Well... this was all well before Pune was ever heard of, as far as I'm concerned. And these were the early days indeed. But it was very interesting to have known Vivek as well as I did, as closely as I did, and to see this radical transformation. And as you say, she became Bhagwan's most intimate disciple. And if you ever saw Bhagwan around, traveling in one of his many cars, sitting next to him, there would be Vivek. And we did correspond. Probably 5 or 6 times over the next, how many years would it have been? I can't remember now. We did. But, of course, I had never seen her again. But I kept to this day very closely in touch with Ravi Arpurakal, who'd been the chap who originally had invited her to India, who had originally met her and who had told us about Bhagwan. But I was the one who came there. Suggested she come with me to see Bhagwan, and that was the way she met Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, later to be known as Osho.
Yeah, so you definitely played a very important role in the story. And
there might be one other thing. I wrote a book that was published called From Guru to God, The Experience of Ultimate Truth, and I wrote about all that in that book. There might be further details. I can't remember. I don't have it on hand. And though it was available worldwide for 10 years through a publisher called, I can't remember the name, but now it's available, published by OM Books in India and only available in India and in the Middle East. How weird is that? Anyway, so finally, look, here's another interesting point. You might enjoy this. We were there one day. It would have been a Thursday morning, the usual satsang with Bhagwan. 5 or 6 or 7 of us in the room, and the door was opened, and a beautiful French model was led into the room, stark naked, with a couple of Mayoga Lakshmi at one side and another neo-sannyasa at the other side, and brought in, and she knelt down in front of Bhagwan, and he spoke to her and put one of his malas on her neck. And that was a mini celebration that lasted for about 5 minutes, and she stood up and left, and I didn't see her again. I don't know what became of her. But after that, a joke was made in the room, and Bhagwan said, and they all said, "Michael, why don't you become a neo-sannyasi? Come on, what's holding you up? Jump, get over it, join us. You've spent all this time with us. You've come to Mount Abu." And anyway, because I was so engaged with the guru, Muktananda, from whom I'd had this intense awakening, despite being burdened by his very conservative notions about spirituality, I wasn't ready to jump ship, so to speak. Anyway, they chased me around the room. That was a laugh, and I jumped over his bed and all this sort of stuff. But finally, that was the moment where they prevailed upon me to join Bhagwan. I'd always had great respect for him. Not only that, probably a couple of years later in America, I met Yoga Mukta and Swami Krishna Christ, and she'd bought a small ashram for him in upstate New York. I don't know what became of it. I don't know whether it was further developed or whether it was used for Osho's work, but I certainly know that I was up there with her and Swami Krishna Christ and another lovely young neo-sannyasini, and we were up there doing some work and tending the gardens and doing something. So that's pretty much the end of the story. And I was very, very sad to hear about her demise about 3 months before Osho passed to the other side.
Yes, that was quite sad. So during the time you were there with Osho, you mentioned that Osho never came out of the room, and so seemingly he was just reading books, right? So he was reading books and giving satsang.
Mm-hmm. And once a week,
okay.
That's it. Maybe for 90 minutes, that's all. And as I say, he was not well known. Only a month earlier, he'd started the neo-sannyas way, and there were only 5 or 6 subscribers by that time, as far as I could tell.
Wow. Things changed quite dramatically within a short span of a few years.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes. And then it's interesting to hear that his health was already not very strong, apparently. Even though if I look at the picture of Osho when he was young, he was absolutely, he looks so healthy, strong. I mean, his body is very robust compared to the average Indian man, especially in the 60s and 70s. And in fact, just recently, I realized that he said in a discourse that for 10 years, continuously, he would run 16 miles per day, 8 in the morning, 8 in the evening. And then we all know that he loved swimming in the river. So he was a very, almost like an athlete in his youth. And then somehow, probably because of the enlightenment, I don't know, obviously, that then his health deteriorated quite dramatically.
Well, that's interesting because it was evident that he looked healthy, very handsome, very healthy, looked robust, looked healthy, not any sign of ailments of any sort. But Lakshmi indicated to me that he wasn't well, and I thought it was strange that he only came out of his room once, and we talked briefly, and he walked around the sitting room, looked at some books, and he didn't appear for more than 10 or 15 minutes, and that was the end of it. Back into his room he went, and I was there all the time. I never left the house, never left the apartment. I didn't feel well enough. He was very kind and very gracious to me, and I always remembered that. Much appreciated.
Yeah, that's wonderful to hear.
Quite a privilege to have had that experience, and also to have introduced to Vivek. I had no idea that she would have become so close to him for all those years.
Indeed. And in terms of, you mentioned at some point that you went back to London, to England, and then you were also close to the family, to Vivek's family. And then you met her at that point after she was already Vivek. So what was the relationship between Vivek and her parents? And, you know, how did her parents react to the fact that she kind of completely changed her life so dramatically?
Well, It's interesting. I tried to recollect what their reaction was. I don't think for a moment they were unsupportive, but they were conservative, conventional English family. I don't think they ever came across to an engaging interest in what she understood and what she believed and what she was practicing. But I didn't get the impression there was any antipathy towards between them and her and over the whole change of the course of her life. But also remember that though she ended up the closest person to Bhagwan, I do believe she came and went a bit. She probably went through some phases of fuller, lighter engagement with his work and being with him in the early few years, I think. It was only later when, well, I don't know, but I'm only surmising that she might have, the closest might have really begun in Pune and on the ranch in America. But there was back and forth. Of course, she was sold the day he spoke to her. But I think she had some ups and downs in relation to the whole, her relationship with Osho, most probably. But as you know, they became treasured ones to each other, no doubt.
Indeed. And in terms of the Indian man, the one that told Vivek to go to India, and you're still in touch with him, can you
very much
a bit more the relationship between him and Vivek? How did Vivek know this man who then kind of broke up?
Well, if I remember correctly, Ravi was a, we wouldn't say extraordinary, but he was a frightfully open fellow, had a mystic touch with him, about him, without his ever cleaving to anything yogic or necessarily any formal form of spirituality. But I think he just turned up in a house that Vivek was in Germany and just sort of knocked on the door and said hello, and the way he might have done. And Vivek has given some sort of an account of that, most peculiar. Not untoward in any way, but most unusual, the way he sort of just came by as if it was providentially ordained by God that he meet Vivek, and that finally he brought her to India, and finally he introduced her to me, and finally I took her to Acharya. It's an extraordinary course of events, really. Something I haven't told you, interesting, I'm reminded as we're speaking, there was another Orthodox Swami there for a time, exactly at the time when I was there, and we talked extensively after my recovery from the hepatitis and living literally with Osho. I actually visited him several times in Bombay after that, but we got to know each other well. And what we peculiarly had in common was that Muktananda at that time, Swami Muktananda, who was there was Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and there was Muktananda, and there was a few other well-known well-known yogis from India. And, of course, Bhagwan was at the early phases of his being very famous. Muktananda was renowned for giving Shaktipat, not by recommending any techniques, pranayama or anything, but simply by his presence and simply by his touch. It didn't have to be touched. You could be in his presence. You could have been reading one of his books on a beach in Bali, thousands of miles away, it would happen. And this was a very peculiar and most unusual phenomenon. It wasn't just a shot. It wasn't just a one-off spiritual experience, but in a significant number of people who came before Muktananda, they enjoy that awakening. In my case, it was extraordinarily powerful and extant for the next 30 or 40 years. If ever I gave over, this very intelligent phenomenon would start working in me. And this chap and I conversed about that, because even when this is relating back to Acharya Bhagwan as well. We discussed it, and he was very knowledgeable about this. One of the very few people who had it alive in him, even Muktananda had not heard of such a thing, this phenomenon. Of course, he knew about Kundalini Shakti, but the way it manifests is what was not classical, if you like. And it was relatively unknown in India. There was another guru in Pune at the time from whom this awakening was known. But as this sannyasi who'd come and spent time with Osho, he knew of four or five other gurus in India who were very quiet, very unknown, and privately kept this awakening within their small circle of devotees. But he maintained, he didn't maintain it in a proud way or a, you know, an egotistical way in any way at all, but he said that this awakening had jumped from him to Osho very much in that period of time. And the phenomenon was one that would jump from me by some sheer mystery, because I was a very powerful projector of this energy without my doing anything for many years. He was the one who said that it was through him that Osho had received that awakening and in turn was able to pass it on to thousands into the future. That would be something that people would not know about, and I believe it was probably privately discussed between this Swami and I don't remember his name at all. And it was only those few days that we spent an exhaustive amount of time in conversation about the whole phenomenon, about what had happened, how unwell known it was, and of course Smoktananda and also Osho and others who made it far more well known around the world in the years that followed. That's a little bit interesting.
Absolutely fascinating to hear. And in terms of the effect that Osho had on people, I mean, this is something that every single person I interview in the podcast, they all say that the most powerful experience for them was to be in the presence of Osho.
And also the transmission, yeah.
The transmission, just to be around him. And also, the at some point, Osho was giving Shaktipat for, I think, a couple of years or so. He would have these his sannyasins, and he would arrange them with music and all the lights off in the ashram, and then he would physically touch them in the third eye and give proper Shaktipat transmission.
Well, what I've shared with you might be germane to that, the history of that phenomenon. Quite amazing. Yeah. So here we go.
Look, Michael, so fascinating to hear all the stories. And I mean, you definitely had a very privileged position to meet Osho in such early days, so intimately, spent 10 days in his house, very close to him. And then obviously you met Vivek before she was actually Vivek.
That's right. And,
Beautiful. Is there anything else you want to add? And then maybe I would love to hear about what are you up to these days? Well, how is your life?
Okay, I'd be happy to share that. But let me think, is there anything else that I can share? No, I think I've covered all that I can remember after half a century has passed. but it was very noteworthy time, and I remember every important aspect of what I went through and what I've shared with you.
Wonderful.
I'm very happy to share with you and very happy for people to know about this, because I was very fond of Vivek and I had no idea. I'd mentioned to a few people over the years that I'd introduced Vivek, and I said, oh, no, I don't think it. But they doubted that very strongly. But then, of course, I've seen the testimony. A woman called Kerry Wright very kindly sent me the testimony of recently I saw just only a week or two ago, of Vivek saying that she'd gone to this house and Michael, an Australian, had come and invited me to see it. I said, oh, my goodness, there it is in writing from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So that was very pleasing for me to hear that.
No, it's wonderful. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your story for us, you know, from a historical point of view, if you like, it's a big value. And then on a personal point of view, it's also very beautiful to connect with you and hear this story. So tell us a little bit about, you know, as a young man, you were with Muktananda, you spent 10 days with Osho. I'm pretty sure you met other enlightened mystics in India. what happened?
I'll run over that. Well, look, after I left, prior to meeting Osho, I and another two people were the first people to invite Muktananda out of India. So he came to Melbourne, Australia in 1970 with Baba Ram Dass, you remember him, Richard Alpert from the famous LSD, LSD days. Richard Alpert was with him, Baba Ram Dass, and an entourage of seven or eight people, and they were in Melbourne with us for 3 weeks. But I'll tell you what, after the 5.5 months I had in the ashram with Muktananda, though I was having remarkable spiritual experiences, I found that there was no substantive change of heart and mind. I hadn't changed in the way I had hoped. You know, I was hoping for a change of disposition, character, and temperament. After all, the Eastern spiritual tradition had come with a pretty big promise of a life free of suffering, ultimately personal transformation and experience of the highest truth or enlightenment. And of course, as I say, despite those experiences that came through the grace of Muktananda, there was nothing changed. And of course, I was at Mount Abu, and that was a tremendous experience, especially absorbing some of the wonderful understandings that Acharya Osho Bhagwan was able to convey. But I was always looking for that which would make the difference. So when I went back to Australia, though I continued to meditate, though I continued to chant in an orthodox manner, chanting the Guru Gita and the Bhagavad Gita and giving over to this awakening that I'd received from Muktananda and that was probably happening through Bhagwan later on, and also doing formal meditation using the mantra Soham. Again, I was practicing for two and a half hours every morning, getting up at 5 o'clock. And during this time, I did a lot of the leading edge personal developments of the program, S Forum, Landmark Education later, Silver Mind Control, the Hoffman Quadrinity Process. A lot of Osho's people got into that later on. So these were the high end, more expensive programs. And I was really looking for the truth, if you like, looking for what would make the difference. And I wasn't a dilettante as a seeker, sort of jumping from one lily pad to another as a frog may, but I was drilling down, if you like, to things as best I could with discipline and application. But all that I'd been exposed to from the awakening of Muktananda and the wonderful understandings of Osho, very liberating to the mind and the heart, and some of the very interesting perspectives that I got from all these personal development programs, never had any regrets. I valued these things, but I'd made the observation that even after a spiritual experience or after a new perspective that was somehow hopeful, engaging, interesting, there was always a leak back to the familiar old self. So I kept pursuing this, kept moving. And then during the 80s, I became a high-end corporate consultant, which was an extraordinary phenomenon. We taught a broad range of personal law and organizational strategies to Australia's second biggest company. It was a huge, finally, a $29 million contract with Telecom Australia. I wasn't the recipient of all that money, but my friend was, who won the contract, and there were six of us delivering this remarkable corporate cultural change program. So by this time, I had a really deep experiential penetration of the old age movement out of India, if you like. I was also a student in New York of Chogyam Trungpa, the famous Tibetan Buddhist monk who'd been an Oxford graduate, had a bad car accident, and then became famous and perhaps more than any other person had put Mahayana Buddhism of the Dalai Lama brought that to the public eye. I was with him. I met Satya Sai Baba. I subsequently went and spent a number of days with Punjaji in Lucknow. So I'd been around. So I'd had this penetration of the Eastern spiritual tradition, the pragmatic, practical world of corporate consulting. Let's find out what works, get the show on the road. Let's change this culture of the companies we were working with. But then after doing all these personal development programs, I might say I had a very broad and deep experience of the human potential movement, if you like. Not only that, I created a program called the Decision Principle Training, which I taught around the world in Switzerland, France, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. So I was really on the march, seriously, as a sadhaka doing sadhana to try to break through. And I really believed that if I created an amalgamation of everything I'd been exposed to, pick the eye teeth out of that me and my friends could finally break through to the gates of heaven. But there was one thing I had never done. I'd never gone into retreat as mystics had in the great traditions. And Buddhist mystics, Hindu mystics, Christian mystics put themselves into complete isolation. So in Melbourne, Australia, perhaps when I was 48 years old, I had a small apartment at the back of my home there. I had the door sealed up, trap door put in there so I could be fed by an accommodating friend of mine. The windows were closed off, and I saw no one, spoke to no one, heard no one for a full 10 days. Now, I did this. It was easier than I thought. It was wonderful. I came out after about 10 days, and the world looked fresh and new and marvelous for about a day. But then again, as with the pattern of all the things I had done, things closed down somewhat, and I came back, leaked back to the old familiar self. And, of course, by this time, 30 years had passed, and I'd matured through time, life experience, of course. If anyone's at all reflective, they grow up through time. So that was a benefit. But as to what I was hoping for, sort of a change of heart and mind that I was seeking all the time, that had eluded me. So I went to America, and I'm answering your question. You asked me what I got up to after I'd those interesting times with Bhagwan. I went to America to run a introductory programs to this decision principle training that I was teaching. And a remarkable experience overcame me. As if pushed into me from outside myself came the conviction that everything I had done, the thousands of hours of meditation, the cognitions, the realizations, even so many of the remarkable spiritual experiences, I realized that they had added up to not what I had expected, what I had hoped for, a change, a real substantive change of heart and mind. After that second experience, I remembered something that I had not told you that was the most dramatic element of my period of retreat a year earlier. It was during that retreat, and it's very important to say this, while in a completely plain state of mind, as I am talking to you now, no suggestion, no hypnosis involved at all, I was getting ready to settle myself onto a couch. And before my bottom hit the cushion, all of a sudden, the image of Jesus Christ formed up in my chest cavity. And with the image came the conviction of who it was. And within 1 second of that, there was an experience beyond all words can tell. And if I was to step it down into the poverty of language, there was an openness and love coming from Christ to me of cosmic proportions, and an invitation as if to say, give me your life and breath and I'll take care of you. Well, I was amazed. I was thrilled. I was delighted. It was as real as anyone might be standing before me in this world, but I didn't know how to respond. I mean, I didn't have a problem with Christianity, the five great traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism. Hey, I was an open sort of guy, but I was cool. I was a yogi. I was a serious Eastern practitioner. And after this second experience that I've just related to you in America, where I realized that everything I had done had not satisfied me closely in the way that I'd hoped, since I'd, you know, turned over every stone for that change to occur, I was driving, looking for a home to buy in Mill Valley, California. And I was catching these preachers on the radio, preachers, you know, my chair. I mean, the first thing I heard, well, they're good talkers. That's all I can say. They're good talkers. But they were teaching and preaching from the Bible. And I thought, well, hey, stay open. So I listened. I didn't like all that I heard. I started to see some concomitant factors between the Bible and the Eastern tradition and all that sort of thing. But it was some of the differences that got my attention. And finally, after I listened to about 150 hours of this, what they call expository teaching or preaching, I had a sort of very sound fundamental understanding of the basic principles of Christ's way from the Bible. And because I'd tried everything under the sun, comprehensively, with discipline, almost exhaustively, I loved it, liked it, was engaging, but what I was hoping for had quite not arrived within me. I saw a big sign on a wall, Billy Graham of all people, not people from perhaps your generation, Francesca, but everyone had heard of him as the most famous Christian evangelist of all times. And he pulled a crowd of 100,000 in Melbourne in the 1950s and all this sort of thing. I saw this. There's only one thing I remembered about that chap. He invited people to decide for Christ. So I thought, well, decision was my thing. I knew about decision. The word decision comes from a Latin word carere, which means to cut. Scissor comes from the same word. Incisor teeth, the cutting teeth. in scene one, start scenes two. So I went along to this thing of his, 22,000 people assembled to hear him speak. I went for no other reason, because I was well understood, had a basic framework of understanding about Christianity. I went along to make a decision for Christ of all things. And, of course, when that moment came to decide, I made that decision, certainly, definitely, no turning back. And what happened in that moment was silent. It was undramatic, but something definitely happened. I can remember thinking, my goodness, something shifted. It wasn't an explosive spiritual experience of any sort. It was quiet, it was undynamic. I remembered that term, born again. You know, what's the born again thing? I'd met a couple of born again Christians. They were nice people. They were had their marbles together, but it seemed to me that as soon as they started talking about this, they jumped track, and I became quite skeptical, but I couldn't dismiss them altogether. So it was way at the back there. So I tried to look for what it is, whatever it is I'd experienced, and I came to the thought it was better than the word peace. It was sort of an existential rest came over me. And what followed that was a change of heart and mind that I had searched for through every strategic means that I could imagine that hadn't borne fruit. And it started to come to me as a free gift of Christ's grace, the Holy Spirit, if you like. And I turned out to be the most surprised convert in Christendom. How on earth this happened to me, I will never know. But Christ must have written on my back from an early age. And I know that a lot of sannyasins, Orthodox Hindus are quite happy with Jesus. They'll include him in his pantheon of gods. And I knew that Osho was critical of Christians. Well, I understand that. But here I was following in the most extraordinary path. And a change of heart and mind came over me that had nothing to do with my own effort, my own practices, my own disciplines, my own dedication, but through a gift of grace. And my temperament changed, my disposition changed. My character started to change again, not radically, but measurably. And for that, I was tremendously grateful. So here I was, finding myself amongst Christians with a very extraordinary background, with very little in common with them, except the gospel, of course, which is that word means good news. And what Christians understood was that Christ on the cross took everything that separates us from God. So that's what I've been up to. I've left, I've written a book on that extraordinary 28-year spiritual odyssey, including my gratitude to Osho, to Muktananda, to all these people. I never repudiated those things. I never went, oh, nothing like that. I was very grateful for everything I'd experienced. It all led to my being belonging to Jesus Christ. So that's where I am now.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. You know, it's an extraordinary story, and you're kind of a little bit the contrary path of most people that go from the traditional Orthodox religions that they're born with in towards East, whereas you are very early on in the East, and then you came back to, you know, as you say, you know, it's something that happened to you, you're happy and it works for you and it's wonderful. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your beautiful story, your memories with Vivek, and your life journey that you found this existential rest in Jesus, and that's beautiful.
So, well, thank you. It's all providential, and I appreciate the ability to speak to you people. God bless you.
Thank you so much. Lots of love. Bye-bye. Okay.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveosho.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.